very warmly this evening. Again, if this is your first visit to us, I do hope we might see you frequently in the future. We're glad you've been able to come to this third in this week's series of talks entitled The Signs of the Times. I want to ask you, if you would, to take up that copy, a blue copy of Matthew's Gospel that you'll find just piled up in the table there, and turn to page 43. For on page 43 you will find Jesus Christ introducing us to what has been the question of the week. You can see it in chapter 16, verse 15, over on the right-hand side there, where Jesus turns to his disciples and he asks them straight, "What about you? Who do you say that I am?" Let me say straight away that this is a personal question and that it is not simply an academic question. And the answers that we come up with will have a profound effect on the purpose and direction and priorities of our individual lives. Across the continents, through the centuries, more than any other figure, Jesus Christ has challenged and changed, influenced and inspired. We can see his imprint, can't we, on the architecture and the literature, on the philanthropy and the artistry, on the devotion and imagination of whole cultures, not least our own. But the question we're asking this week and tonight is a personal question. What about you? Who do you say that Jesus is? I wonder, we're not going to do this, don't worry, in case you begin to panic and head for the door. We're not going to do this, but I wonder if, you know, if I have one of those microphones like they do on those media vox pop things as they walk around the tables, and I was to come round and say, "What about you? Who would you say Jesus is?" I wonder what response you would give, what adjectives or nouns you might choose. Well, now, the method of our investigation this week is really very simple. We are going back to the eyewitness accounts of Jesus' life and teaching, and we've been looking together at what Jesus calls the signs of the times, that is, his words, his deeds, what he said, how he lived. And my job has been very simple. I've simply sought, evening by evening, to lay before you one brief incident each evening in the life of Jesus, and then leave you with the question, what about you? Who do you say that he is? May I just say right at the beginning that obviously in 25 minutes and one brief incident, we can only just begin to scratch the surface of the person of Jesus. And that's why I'm going to wave this again, this Christianity Explored advertisement for a series of courses that we run, which enables one over a course of 7 evenings to begin to investigate this further. But I'll put that to one side for a moment. Right now, Rosie Curtis is going to read for us, and she's going to read from page 40, I think it is, from Matthew chapter 15 and verse 21. And then in a couple of minutes, when she's finished reading, we will look at this incident. Page 40, Matthew chapter 15, verse 21, it says, "A woman's faith." Rosie.
Okay, so it's page 40, and we're reading from Matthew 15, about half the way down the page, verse 21. Jesus left that place and went off to the territory near the cities of Tyre and Sidon. A Canaanite woman who lived in that region came to him. "Son of David," she cried out, "have mercy on me, sir. My daughter has a demon and is in a terrible condition." But Jesus did not say a word to her. His disciples came to him and begged him, "Send her away. She is following us and making all this noise." Then Jesus replied, "I have been sent only to the lost sheep of the people of Israel." At this, the woman came and fell at his feet. "Help me, sir," she said. Jesus answered, "It isn't right to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs." "That's true, sir," she answered, "but even the dogs eat the leftovers that fall from their master's table." So Jesus answered her, You are a woman of great faith. What you want will be done for you. And at that very moment, her daughter was healed. Jesus left there and went along by Lake Galilee. He climbed a hill and sat down. Large crowds came to him, bringing with them the lame, the blind, the cripples, the dumb, and many other sick people, whom they placed at Jesus' feet, and he healed them. The people were amazed as they saw the dumb speaking, the crippled made whole, the lame walking, and the blind seeing, and they praised the God of Israel.
Rosie, thank you very much. Well, I want us just to notice two points this evening, two very simple points with deep implications. First, Jesus is Lord of all. Second, Jesus has come for all. First then, Jesus is Lord of all, and this point is a point about the ultimate, universal, undeniable, eternal authority of Jesus over all powers and all people everywhere. And the point is made in a number of different ways in this incident. It's made by the girl's condition, by the location of the incident, and by the woman's action, and then the crowd's action. Let's start with the little girl's condition, because Matthew is very careful, interestingly, in his gospel, to distinguish between demon possession and what he calls epilepsy and other forms of mental illness. Sometimes he puts the two together, but more often than not, he separates them out. So that this child is clearly in the grip, in some unique way, of an evil spirit. It was C.S. Lewis who identified it as one of the devil's chief tactics to persuade us that he's a kind of comedy figure, you know, in red tights with a forked tail and a trident and little horns. I don't think anybody in their right mind who's studied the history of the last 100 years can fail to acknowledge the presence of a great force for evil in our world. And with the arrival of Jesus, God's Son, here on the earth, it seems that demonic activity was heightened quite considerably, as you would expect, so that here is a child in the grip of some sort of demonic spirit. Verse 22, my daughter has a demon and is in a terrible condition. Here is a direct challenge, if you like, to the rule of Jesus Christ. Here is a desperate mother with a desperate need. And look at the end of the story, verse 28, how Jesus deals with it. You are a woman of great faith. What you want will be done for you. And at that very moment, her daughter was healed. Ultimate, universal, undeniable, absolute authority over everything. And we see it over and over and over and over again through Jesus' activity in the eyewitness accounts. Now, I find it very interesting speaking about this particular passage in the wake of The Philosopher's Stone and Lord of the Rings. For the contrast with Gandalf and with Professor Dumbledore could not be greater, could it? There is no hint here at all, or in any of Jesus' activity, of some sort of endless power struggle, or of an ongoing battle between the forces of good and the forces of evil, so that you're never quite sure whether it's you know who, or he who should not be named, for the Harry Potter fans, who is going to win, or Harry Potter or Professor Dumbledore, or whether it's going to be Gandalf or Saruman who will actually come out on top at the end. Never a hint of that in the action of Jesus. He speaks, the demon is gone. Why, there's not even any bell, book, and candle, is there? No long incantation, no calling in the exorcist. Jesus doesn't even say a prayer. Go home, your daughter is healed. And with that, the demonic force has left her. So the nature of the condition shows Jesus' authority. But it's not only the nature of the condition, it's also the location of the event and the behaviour of the woman. For Matthew deliberately tells us that Jesus has set out, do you see it there in verse 21? Set out from Israel into the region of Tyre and Sidon. Now I want you to do me a favour and just turn to the back of your Gospels here. Keep a finger at page 40 and turn over to page 84. Need a tiny bit of local geography for 2 seconds. Don't worry, it won't last long. Geography is a great subject, isn't it? One fact, one side. Don't forget your colouring in pens. That's how I got my degree. Okay. So you can see Galilee, can't you? Right up there in the top third with the lake. That is all part of Israel territory. And then right up in the north you can see Tyre and Sidon. Now that is significant. For Jesus has already been clearly identified as Lord and King, as God's divine ruler in Israel. But now he heads deliberately outside of the geographical area into modern day Lebanon. And as far as the Jews are concerned, he's deep in kind of pagan territory where other gods might rule. They wouldn't have said that. But he's way outside of the jurisdiction of Israel. And the point is being made that here, right outside the geographical boundaries, he is Lord of all. A demon-possessed child with a word is healed. No kind of tin pot, local, tribal deity, knowing limited geographical boundaries, Lord of all. And now turn back to page 41, would you? For the woman, this Canaanite, comes to him, and in verse 22, she recognizes that he is God's king, the son of David. That is the title for God's king, the king of Israel, the son of David. But then in verse 25, do you see what she does? She comes and she falls at his feet. And that is a technical word, to fall at the feet, that is a classic submission word. It literally means to kiss towards. And it's what you did in the ancient world in the presence of an infinitely greater power or authority. We've actually already come across it this week as the disciples, once Jesus had walked on water, fell at his feet, acknowledging that they were in the presence of the divine King, God himself, walking on the earth. About 8 years ago now, a couple got married here at St. Helens. Actually, it was just over the road in St. Andrews there. And they decided to go away from the wedding in an ancient litter. You know, a kind of thing you carry with a seat on it, like the Romans used to use. James built it out of an old bed and some old boards, and it weighed a ton. They were carried by their ushers on Saturday night from the church over there down Bishopsgate to Liverpool Street Station. But as they approached the station, the Saturday evening train from Norwich was pulling in, and on the train were 200 to 300 Tottenham Hotspur fans who had travelled up to Norwich for the match that afternoon and were now returning suitably refreshed. James was in his tailcoat, seated on the litter. Elizabeth was in her white dress. The ushers were staggering along, carrying them with this mighty chariot thing in their tails. The wedding guests were following in their hats, tailcoats, and champagne glasses. And it was one of those marvellous moments, you know, where two cultures meet, and you just sort of wonder what on earth is going to happen. And it was extraordinary because, I mean, I was expecting a massive punch-up, but to a man and woman, on seeing the approaching litter, the Spurs fans knelt on the station, bowed their heads, crying out, "We are not worthy. We are not worthy." Well, now that, of course, was totally tongue-in-cheek. They didn't mean a thing by it, and it was a good laugh. But this is serious. This woman, you see, is showing herself to be a model disciple way outside of Israel. She has recognized Jesus. He is the Son of David, the King of Israel. He is God himself, walking the earth. She sees his mighty power, and she responds as Jesus expects you and I to respond, by bowing to him in an act, a symbolic act of submission. Lord, help me. You are King. You are Lord. I wonder what adjectives or nouns would you use to describe Jesus? Let's be clear, is no kind of tin pot deity, a tyrant over a tiny tribal minority. This is no local prince ruling over a limited geographical area for as long as the electorate will allow him to. This is God's Son, the King, who with a word banishes evil spirits, who with a word heals the sick, who walks on water, who is Lord over creation, who is Lord over you, who is Lord over me, whether we like it or not, or whether we recognize it or not. Who would you say Jesus is? Oh, he's not just a hobby. You know, some people are into curling, and others take skeleton rides, but those Christians, they do a bit of Jesus. He's not just a fashion accessory. Oh, some people go for therapy to the Priory, and others do yoga with a guru from Balham, and others do a bit of Jesus. He's not just a passing interest or a kind of psychological discipline, a comfort blanket, spiritual comfort blanket for grown-ups. Jesus is Lord. And over and over and over again, wherever he is, in Israel or outside of Israel, he demonstrates the fact through his life. Let me encourage you to take away this copy of Matthew's Gospel and read it. It'll take you about 2.5 hours. I read through it myself from cover to cover just over this last week, 2.5, perhaps 3 hours. And you will find over and again the sheer majesty of Jesus Christ is remarkable. Come on the Christianity Explore course. Look at the evidence. Study it. It stands up under close, careful investigation. Jesus Christ is Lord, whether we like it or not, agree to it or not, or want it or not. Let me say, interestingly, that it is a marvelously, speaking as a Christian, it is a wonderful thing to know the Lord of heaven and earth. A number of years ago, Janet and I experienced a real sadness in the family. I'm not going to go into it now. My experience in pastoral work is that at a time like that, one of the things that dogs people is that sort of hidden fear that I've done something dreadful, or that somehow there is a battle going on between the good and the evil, and somehow the evil is sort of winning, or maybe our family has, you know, just somehow fates have turned against us. Or, do you know what I mean? Something, anybody who's been through the mill at any stage, which anybody with any length of life behind them will have done, will know those kind of... To know Jesus as Lord is to know no superstition, no fear, no fatalism, no uncertainty, no insecurity, for you know the Lord of heaven and earth. It is a wonderful thing. Well, now that takes us to the second point. Jesus is Lord is the first point. Jesus is laudable. The second point is a very simple one. Jesus has come for all. And I want us to see now that the nature of the condition may show us that Jesus is Lord of all, but the identity of the woman shows us that Jesus has come for all. And if the first point is about universal authority, the second point is about the mercy and compassion and the willingness of Jesus Christ to welcome absolutely anybody who bows to him as the woman does. So this point is for the person who may be saying, look, it's all very well for you to talk about Jesus as being Lord of all, but you really have no idea what I'm like. You don't know my past. You don't know what I'm into in the present. I mentioned yesterday evening the Swiss psychiatrist, Paul Tournier, who makes this point very clearly. Complexes, secret imaginations, temptations, vain and unconfessable dreams, a whole world of impulses develop within us. They defy the censorship of our will. We can even have such horrible thoughts that it seems we couldn't bear the shame should they be revealed. I remember a woman saying to me once, you know, you have no idea what I've done, as I talked to her about the possibility of bowing to Jesus. Oh, he would never have me, she said. My past, and she was talking about one or two particular events, hangs around my neck like a great weight. He wouldn't accept me. I'm too flawed, too failed. And the purpose of this incident is to show us not only is Jesus Lord of all, but he has come for all, and that there is nobody, absolutely nobody here this evening, outside the scope of his mercy and kindness. And the point is made by the identity of the woman, it's reinforced by the prejudice of the disciples, and it's driven home relentlessly by Jesus in the conversation that he had with the woman. And when you stop and think about it, the prejudice of the disciples is probably the most ugly event. I think it's one of the most ugly scenes in the whole of Matthew's Gospel, actually. You know, we once had a friend whose daughter was severely mentally and physically handicapped. She was deeply loved. She was a real joy. She was a bright spark, and she brought tremendous richness to everybody who dealt with her. But at the same time, it would be naive to say that she didn't present huge challenges and real struggles. I remember the parents trying to get her upstairs as a teenager, trying to feed her, agonizing over her sense of frustration, her parents' tears of distress at other children who didn't understand and would run away crying from this little girl in the wheelchair. Now, there was nothing at all that they would not have done to see their daughter healed. And so you can imagine the woman, can't you? In verse 22, Son of David, have mercy on me, sir. You see, she's realized who Jesus is. She realizes he can help. And she cries out and keeps on crying out, help me. Now look at the disciples. Isn't it ugly? Jesus doesn't say a word. He allows the disciples' prejudice to come to the surface as they say, send her away. She's following us and making a filthy racket. Isn't that ugly? No compassion. Just, she's a Canaanite. A Canaanite woman. The Messiah wouldn't want to deal with her. Why, he hasn't come for her. He is our king. Send her away. She's really embarrassing. And she's making a filthy racket. Well, how wrong they are, you see, because Jesus now reinforces the point that he has come for all. Now, I want you to concentrate very carefully as we go through this next bit so that we don't have to tackle this in the questions. Because initially, when you read Jesus' conversation, it sounds, doesn't it, as if Jesus is echoing the prejudice of the disciples. Look at him in verse 24. I've been sent only to the lost sheep of Israel, he says. Verse 26, it isn't right to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs. But it cannot be right that Jesus really means he's only come for the lost sheep of Israel, because in verse 29 through to 31, he goes on to heal thousands of non-Israelites. He heads down the eastern side of the shore of Galilee, and he is surrounded by thousands of Gentiles, and he heals them. And in verse 40 following, he feeds thousands of Gentiles miraculously. So it cannot be right to say Jesus has the same prejudice as the disciples. No, he quite clearly doesn't. Rather, In this conversation, Jesus uses the words that the disciples use. He echoes their language to drive his point home. Look at verse 24. I've been sent only to the lost sheep of the people of Israel. That's echoing the language of the disciples. Look at verse 26. It isn't right to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs. That is echoing the language of the disciples. It's not that Jesus thinks she's a Gentile dog. Rather, he is pushing and probing so that we see that when he comes at the end to heal the woman's child, he is healing the child of an out-and-out outsider, a Gentile dog. Somebody who is not one of the lost sheep of Israel. Somebody who is a Canaanite woman. That's why he allows the disciples' prejudice to come to the fore in verse 23. He stays silent while their prejudice comes to the fore. And then he echoes their language and pushes and pushes and pushes and said, No, I haven't come to the lost sheep, so I won't be able to. The woman pleads. I haven't come for the Gentile dogs. The woman pleads. Then he says, yes, I will heal this woman. This Gentile dog, in inverted commas, this non-Israelite, for I have come for all. So do you see, he's echoing the language of his day to push the point home that he has really come for this woman. And then, having made the point, he drives it home by healing the girl, and then he goes on to heal thousands and feed the 4,000. And his point is a very simple one. Anyone who does what this Gentile woman, this non-Israelite woman does, kneeling at his feet, bowing to his authority, anyone who does that can benefit from belonging to him. Well, now, this incident is a huge challenge to the disciples and their prejudice. It is a wonderful comfort to anybody here this evening who has a desire, like this woman, to benefit from knowing God. For in Jesus we find that God welcomes anybody who will submit to his authority. Let me tell you what I did to try and drive this point home for myself when I was preparing. I got a sheet of paper, and I drew a kind of, you know, a couple of lines like that across each other. And I wrote race, creed, condition, profession. And then I wrote at the top, Jesus is Lord of all. Jesus has come for all. Every race, Afghan, Alaskan, Albanian, American, Andorran, Angolan, Zairean, Zimbabwean, Zambian, why, even the French. Yes, he has come for them. He is Lord of them. Anyone, anywhere, at any time. If you're here this evening as a French person, we're absolutely delighted to have you. We love France, we love the French, we love the Euro. No, let's not go too far. Every race. Every creed, animist, atheist, materialist, Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, anyone, anywhere, at any time, who will recognize the authority of Jesus and bring their whole life to him and submit it to him to follow him. He has come for anyone. Every condition, wealthy, destitute, privileged, deprived, sick, healthy, straight, gay, single, married, divorced, remarried, murderer, thief, abuser, abused. Anyone, anywhere, at any time, who will come to Jesus and bow to his authority, he welcomes. Every profession, banker, broker, student secretary, trader, teacher, medical doctor, spin doctor. Why, even the lawyer. Anyone, anywhere, at any time, You know, just this last week, I read the biography of Jonathan Aitken. Do you remember those Guardian headlines? He lied and lied and lied and lied. The amoral architect of his own ruin. Jonathan Aitken has followed the example of this model believer. He has bowed and submitted his life to the authority of Jesus Christ, and Jesus welcomes him with open arms. Why, do you know, this is the most glorious truth, isn't it? It's a great challenge if you're a prejudiced disciple with this ugly, prejudicial hatred of the outsider. But it's a glorious challenge, isn't it? Because it means that Jesus Christ has come for you. Even you, with all your baggage, all the rejection of Jesus Christ that has gone before, he has come for you, and he demands that you submit to him. Let me say, as we close, that as a Christian, that is an enormous encouragement. You know, there have been numbers of occasions over the last years. I can think of two or three particular instances that still stick in my mind, of which I am deeply ashamed. I'm not going to tell you any of them now. It's none of your business. But I sometimes think to myself, you know, if the people of St. Helens knew, if they really knew what William Taylor is like and what he's capable of, well, this is the most wonderful passage, isn't it? Jesus is Lord of all. He has come for all. Who would you say Jesus is? What adjectives would you use? What nouns would you use to describe him? He is Lord. He demands that you submit to him. Not to submit to Jesus would be the most offensive thing that you could ever do as far as God is concerned. To go on holding out against Jesus Christ in God's eyes is actually evil. But as you turn back to Jesus and bow to him, you will find he will accept even you into his family. Well, now we're going to have question time, so if you'd like to fill out some questions, I would love to have a bash at answering some of them, and we'll have question time at 9:10, so we've got time for pudding now, and then we'll resume again at 9:10. Thank you for listening.
May I interrupt us once again? And so we've had some really excellent questions, so thank you very much for thinking so clearly. And what we're going to try and do in the next 20 minutes is to get through as many of them as possible, and we'll see how we go. William, first of all, isn't there more evidence that Jesus was the illegitimate son of Mary, brought up by Joseph as stepfather, and became a prophet in response to his dysfunctional family origin?
Thank you very much. That I think it's really helpful to tackle a question like that, because there are ideas around like that which simply don't bear with the eyewitness evidence that we have. They're put about. I don't know where they come from, these kind of ideas, but they don't tie in with the eyewitness evidence that we have. Let's turn back to Matthew chapter 13, and it's on page 36. So if you just turn to page 36 for a moment, look at what Jesus' own townspeople say of him. They're trying to work out who he is, and they say, verse 54, he taught in the synagogue, and those who heard him were amazed. Where did he get such wisdom, they asked, and what about his miracles? Isn't he the carpenter's son? Isn't Mary his mother? And aren't James, Joseph, Simon and Judas his brothers? Aren't all his sisters living here? Where did he get all this? Now, does that sound like a dysfunctional family? Joseph is the local carpenter, a middle-class businessman in the area. Mary is there in the town with them. The brothers, Mary was a busy lady, wasn't she? James, Joseph, Simon and Judas, plus all the sisters as well. Now that, I'm afraid, just does not sound to me like a dysfunctional family. And that they're trying to work out who he is. They can't deny his miracles and they can't deny his supernatural wisdom. They were there. They saw it. If it was a hoax, they would have said it was a hoax. They can't deny it. So so the townspeople are trying to work it out. But actually, when you start, that's why I say read the eyewitness for yourself. And you'll find those sort of ideas quickly scatter away because they just don't bear any relevant, they just don't bear up with what the eyewitnesses say. Thank you.
A related question. A woman who is desperate for her child to be healed will say anything. How is what she says showing great faith in Jesus as Lord?
Thank you very much. Yep, that is absolutely true. But she is a Canaanite woman. She is outside of Israel. The Canaanites were historically the enemies of Israel. And she gives him, from the very word go, the title, Son of David. Now, Son of David is a technical phrase, and it means God's King, Lord of Israel, King, ruler. So from the very word go, she shows that somehow, who knows how, somehow, she has twigged to the real identity of Jesus Christ. And she shows that it's not just a kind of flash in the pan, because actually her theology is better than the disciples'. It's very interesting, isn't it, the way Jesus deliberately stays silent, allows the disciples' prejudice to surface, and then pushes the woman. I've only come for the lost sheep of Israel. But, she says, help me. I won't come to help the Gentile dogs. But, she says, knowing her Old Testament better than the disciples do, that it's right that the dogs eat the crumbs under the table. So this is not just, I mean, she's desperate, quite right. She actually needs help. But it's not kind of desperate casting around for any solution, you know, the way people fly their children to New York and then off to China and then chasing this and that and the other remedy. She has seen who Jesus is, and now she almost pushes him to do what he should do as Lord of all, which is to welcome all. So it's not just desperation.
A number of questions on this theme of Jesus as Lord. Is Jesus on an ego trip because he's willing only to welcome people if they bow to him? If Jesus is Lord of all, how could he have been tempted by the devil in the wilderness?
Thank you very much. I'd love to take you back to the temptation of Jesus by the devil in the wilderness, because he is the first man ever in the history of the universe never to give in to the temptation of the devil. He is the only man, and that demonstrates that he is Lord. So the interesting thing about the temptations in the wilderness is that the devil takes the classic temptations that you see all the way through the Old Testament, and he tests Jesus on them. And at every point, to the deepest level, Jesus resists temptation, demonstrating himself to be Lord. So the very fact that he resists, I mean, our humanity, surely, is demonstrated by the fact that we give in so easily to temptation, so easily. Whereas Jesus resists to the deepest level the classic temptations that run all the way through. Is he just a despot? The answer to that is yes, if he's wrong. So it was C.S. Lewis, wasn't it, who said, for goodness sake, don't go away saying Jesus is just a nice bloke. That option is not open to you. Either Jesus is a despot, making outrageous claims, calling people to leave their families, to put him number one in their life, resulting in thousands of people being put to their death down through the centuries, persecuted for being Christian, asking for absolute submission in the whole of life. Now, if he is not Lord, he is a despot. He's certainly not just a nice bloke. You can't say he's a good man. He is either Lord or he's wicked. And if you're here as somebody who's investigating, for goodness sake, don't go on with the sort of patronising nonsense that people give to Christians, that Jesus is just a good bloke. Because, you know, that's just lacking in logic, apart from that. C.S. Lewis, isn't he, in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, when he's running through this logic, speaks to the children, the professor speaks to the children, I think it's about chapter 4, he says, logic, logic, do they not teach logic in the schools these days, really, in that kind of, you know, marvellous way? And it's right, isn't it? I mean, you cannot say Jesus is just a good man when you start to look at his claims. Either he is Lord, or he's a lunatic, or he's a wicked liar. But for goodness sake, don't go away saying, oh, he's nice, just a nice bloke, and I'll pat him on the head and have him in my sort of potpourri of spiritual advisers. No, that's just not open. It's illogical.
So you're saying read the documents, read the primary evidence.
Come and investigate. Yeah, it stands, it is falsifiable. Jesus, the Christian religion is the one religion that relies on factual, historical, falsifiable evidence. Come and look at it. Come and look at it. Examine it for yourself. Look closely. Think about it, please. But don't go away with the idea that Jesus is just a good bloke. But the question is he a despot?
Yeah. Can we go on to the next question?
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Marvellous. I think it ties in.
It's choreography.
Totally unplanned. It ties in, I think, with what you just said, which is this. What you've just said sounds wonderful, but doesn't your evidence come from a rather biased source? How do we know that we can rely on it? And then another question about how can I believe the gospel? How do I know it's reliable?
Yeah, thank you. We've had this question every single evening. It's a very important question. And as I say, you know, Christianity it impacts the whole of life. And I hope, come to questions on what does it mean for me. But it does rely on solid, factual, historical evidence. And it is important, therefore, that one is able to look at the factual historical evidence closely. I've tackled this question a number of different ways. Let me say, first of all, that there is an excellent book at the back, which if you really are a serious inquirer, you should ask the person who brought you to buy for you. They'll buy it for you. It only costs them a fiver. And it's called The Case for Christ. And if you brought a table of eight, it's an expensive evening. But do buy this. Do ask the person who brought you to buy this for you, The Case of Christ. Lee Strobel is, and I always get this wrong, was former legal editor of the Chicago Tribune. And he cross-examines a dozen experts, professors, doctors, historians, from various faculties and colleges around the world, on the factual evidence for Jesus Christ. Now, if you can cope with the kind of journalistic, you know, as he reached from his desk with his wizened face, you know, and all that sort of stuff, there's a certain amount of that which you have to reach for the bin for. But apart from that, I think it's the best book available. There are books and books and books. There are two big questions. Is what we've got in Matthew's Gospel what they wrote? That is a question of transmission. I answered that question yesterday evening. And I'd love you to get the tape, and you'll get the question at the end. The tapes are there at the back. They're free. You can take one away. The other question is what they wrote what actually happened? In other words, are they reliable historians, these eyewitnesses? And I answered that on Tuesday evening. You can get the tape. You'll see it there at the back. Lee Strobel goes into it. You'd want to ask yourselves questions like, what did they have to gain as they were covered in tar and tied to stakes and used as torches by Nero, as they made this up? And given that their whole thesis argues for integrity and honesty, do we really believe that they just made the whole lot up in a huge lie? I mean, you know, you have to start believing rather more than I do, taking quite a big leap in the dark, actually, rather an illogical leap if you start believing that sort of thing. And then you have to start looking at the distance between what happened and... Have I got a bit longer to answer this question or not?
Minute.
1 minute.
We'll move on. Yep.
I would like just to mention very briefly what I talked about on Sunday evening, which is the other sort of coincidental evidence. So those two areas we could talk about for an hour on each, but what about Tacitus, that ancient historian, 115 AD, was writing about Jesus and Christians? What about Josephus, that highly reliable, non-Christian, Jewish historian, Tacitus wasn't a Christian, who mentions and writes a small amount, tiny little sections, but talks about Jesus. What about the Christians who are meeting in Glastonbury here in the 50s? Now, there's a church just 200 yards down the road where the Christians were meeting 179 AD. There was a congregation there. Now, how do you explain this rapid, sudden extraordinary expansion of people, given that it was within the generation of the people who were with Jesus, the early church fathers. They basically, if you put all the letters of the early church fathers together, you can more or less rewrite the New Testament without the New Testament documents. And so on. I mean, that's just coincidental evidence. I'd like you to do get your friend to buy this book. Take it home. It's a great read, actually. It's easy to read and fun.
We've had a number of questions on the implications of the fact that Jesus is Lord, and this is a good one. If Jesus has come for all and is all-powerful, why is there so much suffering?
Yes, thank you very much. I mean, that is an extremely good question to which Christians have no simple answer. No Christian would claim to have the sort of the magic injection. Let me give you a few areas that you might begin to explore. What we see in the life of Jesus as the crowds come to him and he demonstrates his absolute power over everything that afflicts us is a foretaste of what it will be like to be with Jesus in heaven. So the Bible is very clear that this universe in which we are living has a sell-by date on it, at which point Jesus will return as Lord and Judge and will overthrow everything that opposes him. The reason that there is so much suffering in our world is because of opposition to God, people refusing to live in God's world in a way which honours him. Now that you see not only in areas such as lack of food in certain parts of the world, there's bags of food for everybody, for goodness sake. But we're so selfish. We refuse to live the way God would have us live, and so we hoard all the food for ourselves. One day, Jesus will return and will overthrow all such wicked rebellion against him. And you see a picture of what it will be like when he does that as you see him in operation in Matthew's Gospel. The book of Revelation talks about it. No more crying, no more tears, no more suffering, no more sadness. For everybody and everything which holds out in rebellion against Jesus Christ will be destroyed and overthrown. Now, I'm longing for that day, I have to tell you. It will be a wonderful day. But when that day comes, of course, he will have to overthrow any of us who hold out in rebellion against him. And so at the moment, he is delaying his return in order to enable people to turn back to him. And that's why we go on seeing suffering in our world. Because if Jesus were to step in and overthrow all rebellion against him, let's say in Africa, he'd have to do it here. I mean, he can't just do it in a sort of, oh, well, I think I'll overthrow the rebellion over there, and then I will do a little bit over there, and that would be totally unjust, wouldn't it? So when he steps in to judge and overthrow, it will be universal. But of course, if he stepped in now, where would you stand? Would you be overthrown? Have you submitted to Jesus? You see, if you're holding out, shaking your fist at Jesus Christ tonight still, when he returns as judge, you will be overthrown. And so he holds back from returning, waiting for you to turn around. Be assured, if you refuse to turn around, you will be overthrown. He's demonstrated that. He has shown that he is Lord of all. We're going to talk about this quite a bit more on Sunday morning, so do come back on Sunday morning. But that's the kind of technical explanation of why there's so much suffering, because Jesus is delaying returning. And while he delays, as we continue to reject his rule, of course we suffer the consequences of rebelling against God, which is living in a world under his judgment. Thank you.
Another question about the implications of Jesus being Lord. Are not the different religions simply the attempts of different people from different countries to worship God?
Thank you very much. You've really given us a really happy lot of questions tonight, haven't you? Thank you. That's another very, very good question. And if you are if you're a sincere seeker after the truth, it is a question which should really concern you. I've answered this question on the last two evenings. I think it's such a big one, I want to tackle it very briefly again. Let me tell you about an assembly I did at my 8-year-old school just recently. I went to the school and I said that I'm going to teach you something which your rabbi, your Hindu priest, your vicar ought to, and your imam would also agree with. And I said, I want you to imagine that I have a great aunt Gertrude, which the 8-year-old girls found enormously funny. They thought it was hysterical. I'm not quite sure why. It should be funny to have a great aunt Gertrude, and if your name is Gertrude, I think it's wonderful. But they thought it was funny. And I said, imagine I had a great aunt Gertrude. Would you say, do you think she is tall, she is short, she is somewhere in the middle, or she doesn't exist at all? And they took it in turns. We had 20, we didn't go all the way around school, but the 25 hands went up for tall, 25% for tall, 25 for short. And I got a representative of each to come out to the front. Tall, short, somewhere in the middle, she doesn't exist at all. And then I said to them, what would you say to me if I said all four of these people are equally right? And do you know what they said? We'd think you were an idiot. Because, and I think, I hope I'd made my point. My point was actually being made to the RE teacher who teaches this sort of nonsense. Because the religions cannot be equally true. I mean, think about it for 2 seconds. We'll take it just for 2 seconds. Buddhists believe there is no God. It's an atheistic religion. Hindus believe there are millions of different gods. Muslims and Jews believe there is only one God. Christians believe there is one God in three persons. Now, what do you say to the person, the 20th century, 21st century person, who says they are all equally true? My daughter's friends are right. Not only is it a foolish thing to say, it is also extraordinarily arrogant. It is the arrogance of the 21st century mind that says, I think I know better than all of you, and I'll take the little bits that I like best, and I'll develop my own form of spirituality to suit me. What have I done? I have created God in my own image. I am worshipping myself. The Bible calls it idolatry. What do I say to somebody who says there are all sorts of different religions and they must all be equally true? Think for 2 seconds. Think, please. Get your brain in gear. Even just on the nature of God, that is obviously a fatuous thing to say. Rees-Mogg calls it the spongiform creed of the 20th century establishment. It is. It's spongiform. And it's arrogant, and it's also, it's me saying, actually, I don't want to bow to anything. I don't want to bow to God at all, so I will create my own God and pretend that I'm worshipping it. But it'll only be the little bits that I like. I might just as well look in the mirror and bow down in the bathroom in the morning, mightn't I? Because I'm worshipping myself.
Okay. Time for one more question, which is a good question. It kind of moves us on, really, to the level of the individual. What does it look like in practice to have Jesus as my Lord?
Thank you very much. And there were some other very good questions. I'm sorry, we've only got one. I must have rattled on too long. Have we not got time for any more? No, we haven't. Christianity Explored. You can ask all your questions on Christianity Explored. It is, I must say, a fantastic course. You can have 7 evenings like this, really. What was the question? What does it look in practice to have Jesus as Lord? I said this last night, you know, when I became a Christian, my granddad had this marvellous fob watch. And he just pulled it out and he said, you know, if your watch is broken, where do you take it? Do you just dabble about it in it yourself with your screwdriver? Do you say, oh, well, it may be broken, but at least not as badly broken as the next door neighbours? Or do you take it back to the mender to have it fixed? Christianity is, having Jesus as Lord is like living life in God's world with the instruction manual. Christianity is not saying Christians have all wonderful answers and wonderful lives, but we know the Maker. It's better than having the instruction manual. It's knowing the Maker himself. Christianity is knowing that this world is not just spinning round and round and round, going nowhere. But there is a Creator God who loves me, who cares for me, who knows how I work best, who wants me in heaven for eternity with him, and who wants to live with me now today. Christianity is having purpose to life. Christianity is knowing that I'm forgiven. Having Jesus as Lord is having God's word on how I should be a father, how I should be a husband, how I should be an employer or an employee. It's living life with my Creator. And when I was a 21-year-old, we used to have a little book entitled The Best News in the World. And it is to live life with your Creator, to stop shaking your fist at God and say, I'm going to do it my way in your world, and I'll worship my own petty little idols of money and wealth and success and reputation. To say, no, I will live with you as my Lord. It's the best news in the world.
William, thank you. That brings us to the end of the formal part of our evening. I'm sorry that we haven't had time to answer everyone's questions. We tried to answer those questions which the most people had asked. So if you're feeling a short change, then do ask William or myself, or you might even like to ask the person who invited you here this evening, put them on the spot for a change instead. As I said, that's the end of the formal part of the evening, but please don't feel you have to leave. Do stay, finish the coffee, and chat for as long as you like to. As William mentioned, there are details of a Christianity Explored course, which is starting next Tuesday, on the tables. It runs for 7 weeks, and you'll find the details in there. It's a great course if you want to take things further. You're also very welcome to take away the copy of Matthew's Gospel, which you've been looking at this evening. They're totally free, and do take one and read it. And also on the tables on the way out, you'll see on the tables a number of books and tapes, which again are free for you to take and read and listen to. The last talk in this series of talks, The Sign of Our Times, is this Sunday morning in here at 10:15. No need to book for that, so do just rock up at 10:15. And as I said, that's the end of the formal part of the evening. Thank you very much for coming. We hope you've enjoyed yourself, and do stay around for as long as you'd like to. Thank you.